A lot of our podcasts have talked about the performance aspect, the mentality aspect, the mindset aspect, but what about the logic? What about why do you step on that foot versus another? Why do you, when you're drop kneeing, have to turn deeper and hold timing and freeze certain parts of your core for longer in order for the drop knee to stick?
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. Okay. Tim, my dude, how's it going, man?
Josh, what's up? Good morning.
I almost said welcome to the Test Piece Podcast, and I was like, yeah, you are the Test Piece Podcast. So how you doing, Tim? Good to talk to you. Good to see you.
I'm doing good.
Yeah, you gave me crap about being tired before, so I drink extra coffee now. So I'm just going to be humming along. I'm super psyched. And yeah, Tim, you're in Las Vegas. Your boys are visiting you. How's the Las Vegas scene treating you, man?
It's been super fun. I've been climbing. I think it's just been nice to have a routine, and like, you know, it's clear that the whole atmosphere is a lot healthier for me, and I'm just, you know, kind of happier most of my days. And that kind of leads to more climbing for me, actually, which is strange. I think Salt Lake, for some reason, I was climbing maximum two or three times a week, just a couple hours a day. And you know, now we're going super frequently and, you know, just for fun. And I don't know, it's nice to feel like tired and be like, oh, now I have to take time off. It's been a really long time since Refuge has that's the climbing gym here that I climb at. There's only two other climbing gyms realistically, and one's quite a bit further and one's quite a bit smaller, and Refuge is already kind of small. But anyway, Refuge has this like kind of OG. Brennan went yesterday with the homies. I was resting. But he texted me and he was like, this is like PG Sunnyvale vibes. And that's where we all grew up climbing and just OG feeling. And I was like, I know, it's like, it's amazing. They've really like preserved a really nice like setting atmosphere and like the culture and the group of people who were there. Like, I don't get recognized there like much at all. Like, I don't get like bothered or anything. And that's sorry, like, That sounds super airheaded, but it's a huge
rough, like, Tim. Poor guy.
Dude, it's for me, like,
wants your picture.
Rock climbing is still like, you know, like that old skate park mentality where you just kind of pull up and like everyone's doing their thing. And like, even if that person's like a pro or like the best one there, like they're just doing their thing. And like, climbing culture is really not like that. You know, like, people really want to talk to you, pick your brain. And like, I'll lose 2 hours of my session just to talking to people, you know, and that's always been me. It's always been my personality. Like, even with my friends, it doesn't matter if people knew me or anything, but it's way worse when people do know you and like, they can really take advantage of that, you know, my extrovertedness and like talking and stuff. I don't even feel like I'm extrovert. I just like talk a lot.
I think that's what extrovert is. Well, good news, everyone. You can hear Tim talk for the next 2 hours. Well, it cracks me up that you moving to Las Vegas was good for your health and everything, because my experience with Las Vegas definitely not good for my health or my climbing or anything like that.
That's so funny.
Yeah, dude, I sent you that news article that said that Las Vegas is something like the number one place people are. I don't want to say moving to. I think it was net
buying
Zillow searches, or like it was people who were looking at Vegas homes versus people in Vegas looking at homes outside of Vegas. But I want to hear where you're going to start climbing outdoors. I mean, it's a million degrees, that's kind of the cool thing about Las Vegas, is that it has crags that aren't too far away. And so do you have any outdoor, I mean, I know you're like, you send me pictures of you demoing your bathroom. I mean, you're now an official homeowner, which means real work. But, you know, do you have any plans to get outside anytime soon?
Yeah, no, it's a good point to say that, like, first and foremost, we've lived here for a couple of weeks and we have a house and there's a lot of work to do on the house. And there's just a lot of stuff that I really want to be fixing up and, you know, making sure everything's good. But it's also the summer, and I, you know, read some posts that July was the hottest month, like over 120,000 years or something, like, on the planet. That's crazy, dude. Like, and Vegas is no joke. Like, one of the first weeks we lived here, I think it was like 116 for like 3 days in a row. It's pretty gnarly. And I think that there's a couple of sport climbing crags that are, temps. There are a couple of sport climbing crags that are, I think, like pretty good here in the summer. Like the Roost is a really popular one, or the Hood, but I haven't been to either one yet. And last weekend, Joe Kinder and Owen Whaley went up there, and they invited me, but it was way too hot, they said, when they went. So I'm not super interested in climbing, you know, super hard limestone overhang stuff in the heat, if I could just go to the gym for now. Cause I can just like have, you know, I personally always have a lot of fun at the gym. The access is super easy. I have to be kind of convinced to go out, if it's hot. But, I think I'm planning to go out probably like as soon as temps get under like 80 in town. I think I'll just start night seshing, like some boulders just for fun. I know Michaela has been just like waiting to get out to Boulder. But I will say, yeah, there's a handful of boulders that, so some of the first climbing I did outside was in Red Rocks. So Red Rocks was like the second area I went bouldering, and Brennan and I would spend like a week or two out here at a time. Just like the OG style, just, you know, camping in the car and just like, you know, cruising around, like finding literally everything and anything to pull on, like no real aim for projects or anything like that. We just go to a brand new area and be like, all right, what's cool here? And it was still like relatively low key, you know, back then. Like it was obviously a very popular area, but now it's like, it's a zoo every time you go. So you have to be very like tactical with, you know, your approach. If you're, you know, a stronger climber, and you want to come and send, you can't just like hop from warm up to warm up to warm up, you know, like it is extremely busy there right now. So now I'm picking like very specific projects and probably sometimes, but I think I'm going to start with Trieste. It's a V14 with a V15 sit start that I think is now consensus, maybe just V14 the whole way. And now maybe it's just consensus that the sit start's just the start. I hate when climbing does that, when it's like, oh, stand start doesn't exist anymore. It's like, yeah, it does, dude. I've been trying it for like seasons. And like, it's a clear, obvious thing, but people like to dilute the experience because, you know, everyone likes to make climbing softer. But Trieste is, in my experience, pretty hard. It's a pretty hard style for me, like very, not that overhung and like very, very small holds, very delicate, but tension style. And it's old Paul Robinson line. It's pretty old, I think, actually, like maybe mid 2000. Like,
no, I feel like 2000. It's like not that to me. I'm like, it's not,
it's
that
like 2013,
old, right? It's like
14?
A relatively new kind of test piece of the hard climbs in Red Rocks. I feel like whenever I see people going to Red Rocks to climb something hard, lately it's been Trieste. Like it seems like that's the one.
Yeah, dude, Trieste is, I think, a very underrated line, and it's super fun. And it's just really hard. Like I like that style is, for me, was quite unique to try a, you know, harder boulder that was like, maybe the movements weren't necessarily that difficult, but the holds were just so bad. And like, I think it's a phenomenal style of rock climbing. And then, you know, it's like kind of how it's like in the same area as the Nest, and the Nest is like just the utter opposite style of climbing. And I think that's also pretty awesome. And I'll try the Nest as well.
Well, you got no shortage of hard boulders in your backyard now. Too bad. They're basically on fire. 116 degrees is not okay. When you said we'll wait until temps drop, I was like, what's he going to say? He said drop below 80. I was thinking to myself, I don't know if it's dropping below 80 at night. So, So that's cool, man. I'm glad to hear that you've got some projects. I still want to remind you that when you're talking with Dave Fitzgerald, that, you know, you put out Lucid Dreaming there, and I'm going to hold you to at least a few Lucid Dreaming sessions, because I don't know how much I'll make it down to Las Vegas, but Bishop is kind of in my back. I wouldn't say my backyard, but it's a short jaunt for me. So I'm hoping to see you there. And
100% I'm going to Bishop. It's such an easy drive, but I think, for sure I'll go to Red Rocks.
You've been there a lot first. Is what it is too. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And despite my recent shoulder injury, I still have Mandala sit on the to-do for this year. Cause dude, nice. So I've hurt myself about 2 weeks ago. I don't know. My shoulder feels kind of okay. I still have to get an MRI, which I don't know what to think about when you get those imaging. Like sometimes you get image, especially when you're an older athlete, you'll get imaging done. And they'll just say like, well, it looks like you probably shouldn't be walking anymore because everything is just you. Like I had like a wrist thing, and they did a MRI on my wrist, and there was just all this degenerative, you know, tearing and chondritis or something all over these areas, like in my thumb and my palm. I was like, I don't have any pain there, you guys. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's here. And they're like, oh yeah, you have something there too. But so my point is that be careful when you go and you get imaging done, especially when you're older, because yeah, wear and tear happens. And just because something doesn't look so great under imaging doesn't mean it correlates to how you're performing. But yeah, the reason why I bring this up, Tim, is I don't want to brag, but I hung on the hangboard yesterday. So,
sheesh, dude, that's awesome.
And I'm really like, I mean, it's been less than 2 weeks, and I'm really the kind of guy that I say to everyone, like, you know, do what you can. You should be doing core or working on something when your shoulder hurts, whatever the case may be. And then I'll like sit on the couch and just feel sad myself. I don't know. I don't do that. Actually, I've gotten a lot better at actually just continuing to show up. But I was thinking to myself, okay, even if I need another, you know, month off, if I can just be on the hangboard, I mean, my issue is typically hanging on small holds. And the two hangboard thing I was trying to incorporate into my training for Mandala was, one arm hangs on my left side and, really small crimp training. So, you know, just, you know, sub 10 millimeter, you know, two hand full crimp holds. And I was like, if I can do that right now, then I don't know, like, do I have any excuses? Because my shoulder feels pretty good, but I'm not going to pull on and, you know, start sessioning V10 right now. But if I can in a month, then yeah. So anyways, that's my journey back to my goals, Tim, because I was thinking about the podcast that we dropped and I was so psyched on one about a month ago. And I was so bummed 2 weeks later. And I guess now I'm kind of like in the middle. I'm like, okay, like maybe things are going to be okay. So I'll update you again in 2 weeks and hopefully I'll have been hangboarding and hopefully actually I'll be back to at least some gentle climbing.
Yeah, that's good, man. That's for me, very relieving. I thought you just ruined it and you're bummed. And like, I know you're bummed. And I mean, dude, to be fair, like if anything bad happens and you have experience with injuries and you know already, like you just have like an instant flood of like flashbacks and like, oh, like I'm going to be out for so long and it's so frustrating. It can be so frustrating. So I definitely understand, but within 2 weeks to be able to say like, okay, I'm stoked. Like I can do stuff is like, that's pretty fast. It's a pretty fast turnaround. So hopefully you are going to be good and it's just upwards from here.
Something about being older and having injuries under your belt, it like does both things. Like when you get hurt, you're so bummed. And you're like, oh, like I hate being injured. I hate being on the couch. And then on the other side, you should be like, yeah. And I always get up off the couch and it works out. But I don't know. I think I've said this before. The wisdom here is not so much that you're not going to get bummed. Like as you get older, it's like, okay, Tim, I've done this a bunch of times. You know, what have I learned? Like supposedly I should be older and know something. And the only thing I've really learned is that you can't stop the bum. You can't stop the bummed out feelings, but you can recover from them quicker. So it's, you know, how long do you wallow in self-pity? And, you know, I think I shortened it pretty good this time where maybe before I am a month in and I go, you know what, get off your ass. Like, it's not that big a deal. Like you've been through worse or what else are you going to do? You're gonna bitch and moan or are you going to like get back to it? So I'm back to it. I'm on the hangboard. And that's all I'm going to say about injuries. Cause like I said, I hate talking about injuries, but I feel like I owed you a update.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Should we talk about some cool climbing news that hit the scene? Yeah, it's you know, it's just a V15 send, so it's no big deal. People send V15 all the time. In fact, I'm sure we're gonna see someone flash one anytime or any day now. But Sam Richards did the Big Island, which is a V15 that we all know because I think it's probably the most repeated V15 in the world. So it's probably soft, probably easy. But the dude's only 15 years old. He's only 15, Tim, and this is not okay. I know you know Ashima, and so I don't want to take anything away from her, but sometimes when I see 11 or 12-year-old kids climb something really hard and they use different beta, like I know because I was a kid, I don't want to say a kid crusher. I was strong as a little kid and people would give me crap. Like they'd say, oh, you know, you're really light. Your hands are really small. Or you used a crimp that I couldn't use. And I was like, screw you. I'm a good climber. Like I'm trying my ass off here. There is something different to be said when you see someone who's young and climbing something with the same beta. There was nothing to take away from his ascent other than that when they zoomed up on the poor kid at the beginning, he had pimples because he's only 15. And I was like, Jesus, man. So just hats off to Sam Richards, 15 years old, climbing V15. What do you think of that, Tim? What do you think of someone who's only 15 doing something like that?
I do think the most interesting point of what you're saying there is like, you know, growing up, I would always have some like kids who were like younger than me go to the red and like send hard 514 in like the Madness Cave and be like, I don't know, there's another one of those. Like they don't even get pumped and stuff like that. And yeah, there's an aspect there where it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe it is easier for them. But also like, you're also right where it's like, they're working really hard. They're really focused. They're really good at what they do. So, you know, we couldn't take anything away from that, but it is like a little bit more saturated that kids succeed on a very specific style, right? If they were to succeed, they're going to succeed on a specific style. So the Big Island is this extremely steep, very slopey, like very intricate style of climbing that, yeah, you don't see younger people succeed on very often. And Mirko Caballero was like in kind of, he's more in my age range. It was a couple years younger than me, but you know, back when I was a kid, he was a prodigy too. He was the youngest climber to climb V14. He climbed V14 at 13. He climbed Metal Arc Lemon Sit. Similar thing. That's why it was so impressive. It wasn't just that, you know, Mirko was a 13-year-old doing V14, which is, you know, insane, but it was Metal Arc Lemon Sit, dude. Like very intricate, big slopey, like compression style, like really weird heel hooks and stuff. And like the Big Island's the same thing. And I don't know, you guys should watch the video. It's on Mellow. It's pretty awesome. Sam Richard. And dude, also like the one thing that I actually noticed the most was not so much his climbing. Like I'm not that amazed anymore when I see like 15, 16 year olds climb like amazing. But his body is so like built. How is he so jacked at 15? Yeah, like, you know, like
I was going to say, dude, that too. That's 15. I was like, me at 15. I had the pimples. I didn't have, the biceps.
Same here. Yeah, dude. Like I really made me think, like I've heard this mentioned so many times before, but competition should be separated by like build or like size, maybe some aspect of it, you know, like age is not a good correlation. I remember Ross and Sam, like in youth nationals watching like pictures and videos of them, like literally a foot taller than every other single kid. And like sequencing, they'd just be tall, like completely towering over other people. And like, it just happened, you know, and also watching Drew and Kai, like they're my age growing up, and every single year in youth, they were like back to back duking it out, which by the way, was like a way kind of to debunk this every route setter point at those two, where it's like, dude, they have like a foot difference and we're able to separate them. And you know, they're not, one person's not winning every time. Like, you know, they were trading wins. And that was fascinating as well. But it's just funny. Like climbing is an obvious sport where like reach is just a variable that we like cannot necessarily surpass when it comes to testing people. So just brought up an interesting thought. I was like, dude, this kid's 15 and he looks like, I don't know how I felt when I was like 23, 24.
Dude, today. He looked like he was living a good life. They're, you know, cruising out, I think I thought maybe they drove from Paris, but they just had like this crew of psych kids that just, it looked like a good time. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that at 15, he looked somehow super different or weird. He just was a really muscular, in shape 15-year-old, but mm-hmm. did make me think of my dad telling me about when he was running track and he was, you know, like a junior in high school. And he said he went to state, you know, like the state hurdling championship or whatever. Just he'll never forget. You know, for those of you who aren't looking, you know, I'm a skinny white kid, and that was my dad. No big surprise. And he just said he remembers like getting in the blocks, you know, and looking next to him and just seeing full grown men with beards. And he's like, I am not that. And you know, I mean, of course, it all evens out, and that's why I'm not so sure it matters so much what the age is in youth competition, because you know, when you step on that open field, you know, when you're whatever, full grown or actually in case of Serato, still probably growing, you know, it just doesn't matter. But, I don't know. It makes me wonder about climbing and where it's going and seeing these young athletes climbing these things that are not, there's no tricks to them that they're pulling. They're just climbing a really amazing V15 that I'd call that style. I like calling that style a tech burl, where it's kind of compression. It's clearly not just thuggy power because you have to keep your feet on. It's intricate and delicate, but it really requires that strength. I don't know. I guess the reason why I find that stuff interesting is that when I started climbing, I was probably one of the first generations of like stronger kids. I mean, it's just, there was no kids climbing because there was no gyms. And so when I started climbing at, 8 or 9 years old, in fact, here's how ridiculous it was back then. I would go to the local competitions and I would just compete in, advanced or whatever, not open, like advanced. But I was a kid, and because there was no kids categories, and I have all these hilarious pictures of me like standing on the podium. And back then you would get prizes, like they would sponsor, Grimici would sponsor, you win a rope or a pair of shoes if you won your category. And I'd win these clothes and they'd be, large men's pants, they'd be as big as me. It always makes me wonder about kids and their abilities and how it relates to growing up. And, do kids have some kind of special thing, or do they only have special things in certain, types of climbs, like you were mentioning? And, so far we usually see that if a kid is good young, like look at Adam Andra, was he just a flash in the pan at 13 years old? No, he was not. It'll be fun to see what Sam Richards ends up doing, but congrats.
Yeah, you definitely bring up an interesting point there. Like, it was not something I had to learn as I got older in climbing. Like, I got, pretty good at climbing pretty quickly. And like, by the time I was in my 16, 17 year old range, like, was easily one of the strongest climbers at the gym, if not, one of like two or three strongest climbers at the gym. We were just the bros walking around, and like, we could do everything in the gym, and there would always be like Jeremy and like Joel Rusher who would like walk it through the door. And I'd be like, wait, you guys are like way stronger, but in a way that like, you're not going to send these climbs in here necessarily, but you're way stronger. And like, there's just something to be gained as time goes on. But I climbed V10 in the gym within my first year of climbing. And that was only because Mirko was climbing at the gym, because Ross was climbing at the gym, because all these other kids were climbing at the gym. Ross wasn't even by far the strongest kid at that time, and like, there were so many kids, like V10 was lapped in the gym, like all the time. And like, so for me, the standard was like, but that still for me seemed extremely difficult. And I just did whatever it took to send that climb. And so, my point is, in this generation, like this kind of was what we were talking about in Japan, like why the kids are so good, is because like when the kids have the mentality, if a kid has a mentality, when they walk in, they say, all right, I'm gonna do the hardest thing in here by any means necessary. And kids are like that. Adults are not really like that. Kids are like that, right? Kids possess this like, all right, that, I'm going to do that. I don't care what it takes. I'm doing that. And when you have a kid like that, but the ceiling that already exists is super, super high, they just make it happen. And I think like that's the thing that's going to change over the years. It's not so much the core ability of climbers. Like, I think you're always going to look at the 30, 40 year old climbers and be like, oh, they're really strong. Like, that's what it looks like to be, climbing for 20, 30 years. But the kids now, the kids, like the earliest generation, are going to push that, level of sending way earlier on, I think, just because, the ceiling is way, way higher. And not to say that like the Big Island is, a new climb or anything. It's been done for a really long time. But, Sam Richard, I'm sure as a child was like, oh, like a lot of young people can climb super, super hard, so I might as well go for it. I'm not sure. It sounds like I do like what you were pointing out. The video was, I think, dope. Like, they brought out a different energy and like a little bit of a storyline, and like you could see like him and his friends and stuff. And like, I don't know, it seemed like that was just a regular thing in his life, just to like try this climb over and over again. And he just did it. And it happens to be V15, but it looks like a totally similar experience as to like probably what you and I had when we were younger.
Yeah, he said he had only climbed V12 beforehand, which was
interesting. That's insane.
Well, but it just goes to your point of, that seems like a wild jump, but in his head, for him, the ceiling is, V16 or V17. And that's just a PSA to everyone who's running a gym, set harder boulders. Like, the kids will rise to the challenge. And dude, I got one thing I just remembered about Mirko, because you brought him up a few times. So I met Mirko at Planet Granite, Sunnyvale, but I was climbing with his older brother a bit, Yolan. And what was hilarious is I remember Mirko because he was in gymnastics at the time because his parents were really good gymnasts. And he wanted nothing to do with climbing. He was just, I remember because I was in gymnastics, so I like thought it was cool because he was, you know, this little six-year-old kid doing backflips and stuff. And I remember he just wanted nothing to do with climbing. And then one day it just switched. He was like, oh, I like this. Like,
that's so funny.
All the time. I'm going to do it. Yeah.
Dude, it's so funny because Jason Kell was just on our podcast. I like have been seeing his posts a little bit more often on my Instagram. And I saw that he was doing some talk, I think, with Waltopia, I think in Romania, I think it was, or somewhere.
It's the WIX. It's the World Indoor Climbing Summit.
So okay. He was doing a talk and he took a picture with Kilko, Mirko's dad. And I just happened to recognize like Mirko's dad, who was this kind of legendary, like, you know, militant father figure who was like drilling Mirko and training all the time, which for a lot of people saw that as a bad thing. But I was like, that's pretty epic. Like you don't see that in the sport very much. And obviously like, you know, led to some, you know, different things in the future. And Mirko doesn't climb anymore. He doesn't really climb at all anymore. And you know,
it, for anyone listening, finger injury? Didn't he have a bad finger injury?
It was a lot of stuff. He moved to Switzerland. He moved to Switzerland right when he got his finger injured.
Yeah,
but as a kid, you know, when you're a kid and you have like something to prove all the time, and Mirko was a rock star in climbing, like at the time for sure. Like, you know, if you saw him, you definitely knew who he was. And yeah, I apologize for all the listeners. Like we are name dropping someone that you probably, you know, guys don't know.
I don't know. He was pretty famous.
No, people really don't know Mirko in today's day and age, in my experience. But if you know him, that's awesome. But you know, you probably don't know him. And yeah, he was just the prodigy of like, you know, when I was 14, when I was 15, 16, and he was the prodigy. But yeah, he moved to Switzerland, got like I think two growth plate injuries, and then he like grew a couple inches and gained a ton of weight just because he was growing, and he got back into climbing. I remember he like Snapchatted me. He was like, dude, I like fell on like a V12 and I'm like so pissed. And I was like, welcome to my world. Like we don't send V12 all the time, but you know, I can imagine that's just super discouraging and being, you know, he also just became like a very, very good skier, like right after that during his injury. And I think for him, everything was easy and just could go into whatever he wanted. So hopefully he's doing well. Good luck, Mirko.
Yeah. Well, we'll close that loop by just emphasizing again that kids will rise to the challenge. You know, I was talking with someone locally here. I'm in the kind of in the Tahoe area, and I think what Jimmy and David Fitzgerald and Carlo and Roman are all doing up here in Tahoe is really important because they're just establishing hard boulder after hard boulder after hard boulder, and there's going to be a whole bunch of kids growing up here that are on Instagram or actually not just on Instagram, they're out there fondling those V15s that Jimmy just put up and thinking to themselves, oh, I'm going to do this or I want to do this. And what happens is if you have that mindset at eight, you know, even, you know, you can work your butt off and in 7 years, that's a long time. You know, you might do it at 15, right? You know, and 7 years or being 15 years old doesn't sound that old, but dedicating yourself to something for 7 years. And you know how kids are, they don't half-ass it. They're climbing, you know, 7 days a week, for 3 hours. And it does, you know, we always stand on the shoulders of the generation before us. And it makes me wonder just, yeah, what's capable. Also, I don't want to say it makes me sad, but it makes me wonder how my climbing career would have been different. So when I was a kid, I climbed like a 12D when I was like 11 years old. And yeah, we didn't really boulder. So it was sport climbing. And I just remember someone looking at me and there was some switch when I climbed that. They were like, oh, that's actually hard. And I mean, you know, in today's world, it's like not, you know, but I don't know, for everyone out there who climbs 12D, it's not easy, right? You know, and I'm not saying I was great because clearly it's like a joke now for, you know, there's like 12-year-olds climbing 514 or something. But, you know, it just makes me wonder, you know, what a guy like Sam is going to do in 3 years or what, you know, these kids around here are going to do. Are they going to climb V15 at 13 or what's the limit? And then I guess more interestingly is what happens when you take someone who's dedicated the last 7-10 years of their life and then you add another decade or two because, you know, Adam Andra is not getting weaker. I don't know how old Adam is. Although big mistake, Adam, having a kid, that's going to ruin your climbing. no, I just kidding. I love my children. Okay. All right, Tim. Let's move on to our next segment. You were not there for me getting to interview Will Anglin. It took me a while during the intro to mention that he was the founder of Tension Climbing. I've said this. I don't know why. I think it's the coolest climbing company maybe in the world. There's just something very cool about Tension. It just really represents kind of what I think of when I think of cool climbing companies. And so I felt really privileged to get to talk to Will. I just really enjoyed it. I said this on the air to him, and I'll say it again. He just really felt like a student of the craft. And, you made a comment about how listening to it, it kind of reminded you of what we like to talk about. And I think that's why I enjoyed it so much, is I almost felt like I was talking to you, Tim, but I mean, he was wearing glasses too. But Tim, did you get a chance to check it out? Reflections on Will?
It was fascinating. It was definitely a very long podcast too. And I won't go as deep as I went in the Jason notes, mostly because I want to talk about our topic for the day and I want to make sure we have time for that. But also, yeah, kind of Josh said it, the feeling that I had listening to it was he very much gets a lot of the same like philosophies that we try to, talk about and like uphold in our climbing and like our coaching and whatnot. He's a coach, he's created Tension off of his discoveries and his research. And, for me, the most fascinating thing was his experience, just like all the people he's climbed with, all the people he's watched, met with, experimented with, I think is like really rare, to get the time with somebody else who is just as dedicated as you are, to get the time with somebody who's probably better than you are, and like to actually get that time, right? Because there's one thing to climb with them, and there's one thing to like, go in session with them or go and compete with them or something, but to like go into your little dungeon facility and like make boulders, like I thought that was so cool. He was like making different boulders. Like I remember doing that. Like I remember setting for like Ross and Sam all the time and like the other guys on the team and just being like, all right, guys, like, what do you think? And they just like break beta, like, skip a hold. I'm like, why would you do that? Like get angry and be like, why use that hold? And they're like, why? I'm going to do it the easiest way. I'd be like, huh? Like, that's fascinating. Like it is to you, it's easier to do it this way. So I have to see climbing through your lens. And he kind of said that about Daniel Woods. And I just wanted to hear more of it. I thought, it was fascinating to hear, a little bit. And I wish I heard more, but I heard a lot of really interesting concepts also laid down that I think a lot of these concepts we've gone over in a lot of our podcasts and like gone super, super deep, but there were definitely some concepts that I think were like really good to highlight. It was cool to hear about the Tension Center experience and like the aura of all the legendary next level climbers. It was kind of cool to hear, you brought up Matt Foltz as being like currently one of the best climbers. And I agree with you. I think Matt Foltz is considered one of the best climbers, one of the best boulders in the world right now. But Will was talking about Matt talking about Jimmy in like another trip and like another experience and being like, oh dude, if Jimmy flashed a boulder, it was, if Jimmy didn't flash a boulder, I didn't think I could even do it. So if he flashed a boulder, I still thought it was a maybe that I could do it. And I thought that was fascinating. Like there's definitely that level of a difference between like the most legendary. And, I think the difference between someone like Jimmy was that the level of mastery in Jimmy, what Jimmy possesses is not just the understanding of rock climbing as a whole, but also just like sending and performance. Like he really understands that aspect, I think, better than a lot of rock climbers do. I think Matt probably got a lot better at that aspect over time, but his core ability probably was close to Jimmy at that time. I'm not sure, but I think Matt was extremely strong like for a really long time.
I really do want Matt to come on at some point, and I want to hear his take on that now, because we may be, we're getting all that information secondhand, and I don't know. It's just interesting to hear it from the horse's mouth. And it does seem like Matt, something I really respect about Matt's approach is that very hard work. I mean, I don't know Matt. I just see him on Instagram totally. And things. And I just feel like he's someone who deeply believes in his ability to try hard, on the rock, off the rock, every day for years and make his dreams happen. And I just think that's a good mentality. And when you compare him to Jimmy, I don't know Jimmy super well. I've climbed with Jimmy. I messaged with him, but I don't know him super well. So I don't want to say what he does or does not do for training. But something that always struck me as really interesting about Jimmy is how he progressed in the sport. And I remember when Jimmy came on the scene and you know, you hear about a guy doing a hard V14 in the South or something, and you hear about him flashing a 12, and then you hear about him going to Rocklands and flashing a bunch of V13s, and you go, okay, who is this guy? And, you know, probably to us now, you may just think, oh, Jimmy was like a superstar, but there was a time when he wasn't, right? And what was so incredible about Jimmy, I've heard this from some of my friends who climb with him in the South a lot, is just this consistent, basically linear progression, where a lot of us, the whole freaking podcast is about going from good to great, because going from good to great is fucking hard. And there's a reason why we hit plateaus. It's because it's hard. And something that always struck me about Jimmy and why hopefully we'll get to interview him at some point is, how did he not really have a big plateau? How did he go, he hit the scene doing a V13, a V14, now there's a V15 and a V16. And, not to take anything away from Matt Foltz, and this is where I want to see the behind the scenes of both guys like Matt and Jimmy, is, Jimmy almost seemed like he just kept growing. And Matt has kept growing, but he's very public about what he's doing behind the scenes to ensure that growth. And, is that these different climbers just seem to have these different trajectories, and we all have to find our own path, but that's what's really fun is digging into the reality behind the scenes.
Yeah. I think that just goes to show you, I don't have an answer for them. I'm not even going to try to answer that, because I think it can go really deep and, really controversial. But the observation that I've had in climbing over the last couple of years, and something that we like to highlight, is there is no right one correct approach, but it seems like a lot of different approaches to growth in climbing come from different places. This whole Japanese scene and the whole Jimmy Webb, kind of concept. And it seems like Jimmy doesn't do much specific training. He probably does, but it's most people wouldn't know, and I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't train at all, just climbed really hard all the time. Actually goes into a point that Will brought up that I think was super interesting, he called it damage on the wall, right? Getting as much damage on the wall as possible. I really like this philosophy. I think for me, it's very, very true to how I train and climb. And I see it in a very opposite way than Will does, to be honest, where we both see it as climbing movements on the wall can do a lot of damage, right? So all the pushing and pulling and active movements engage all the muscles. And for him, that kind of can replace some workouts that he was already doing before. And he was talking about his obsession with training and lifting and all this stuff. And then he probably maintains that obsession of training all the time. And for me, it's actually those things are how I create what I train on, right? That whatever was sore and whatever I couldn't last on, I would do as much damage to myself on the wall as possible to see what my body couldn't do afterward, right? To be okay, what was my body able to do and what was my body not able to do? And that's what I would form my training off of in terms of intensities and capacities and volume, right? To see, okay, how much of this should I be doing and how much of this should I be doing and how long should I be doing this for? It was basically as long as I did enough damage to myself on the wall, I could see it. But it's the same philosophy where I think a lot of us see doing the work off the wall and then trying to perform that work on the wall. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we go on the wall and we do our best, right? We have a theory and a conception of what the best way to do something is. And that's always changing. That goes into our topic of the day, which is sequencing, right? We get better and better at this. And I even wrote a note on sequencing that will kind of come up later, but I think the ability to sequence usually has a correlation to a climber's max capability and skill output. Right. Their core understanding of climbing is usually correlated to their core output, right? Their potential output. And I think because of that, we have to constantly work on all aspects. And this kind of goes back to what we were just talking about with Matt and Jimmy and style. Also something that Will and you and Will talked about this really nicely, I think. Just the application of style and the observation of style and then the application of it, I think was just an interesting conversation that I'm not going to go into. But my point there is that there's so many different approaches. And it really seemed to me, Matt Foltz was an outdoor climber who competed a lot, but he was, to me, seemed mostly an outdoor climber who did all of his work and prep in the gym and then would go out and do the whole process outside, but mostly would go out to perform. And Jimmy spends a lot of time outside and learning and theorizing and philosophizing outside and performing outside. And it clearly just you know, breeds a different climber and like a different approach. And I'm not going to sit here and say one's better than another, but you're going to end up being a different athlete, right? And there's so many different places for athletes to shine. And, you know, we don't want to just be counting like outdoor sends as one classification of how good an athlete is, because yeah, I'm sure you'll see Matt Foltz do something in the gym that maybe he's one of a kind. And I think it's all fascinating, just the approach.
Well, I mean, we talked about this a little bit in the last podcast, this idea of you have to fall in love with what you're doing. And these guys don't have constraints as much, but you know, if you tried to fit one climber into another's routine, and I just know from Instagram, Jimmy hikes a lot. He climbs outside a lot. I know he's on the Kilter board a lot, but I guarantee you that he's doing that stuff because he really enjoys it. And, you know, I don't know if Jimmy does a bunch of, I don't know, you know, finger block deadlifts, you know, like I really don't know if he does it, but my hunch is that if he, whatever he's doing, it's because he enjoys it and it's leading to him having gains. And so, you know, finding your own way is part of being able to show up and try your hardest. And, you know, I mean, one thing that I've said a few times, and I think is worth repeating, is understanding the amount of volume that hard climbers actually do. And, you know, Will jokingly talked about trying to climb like Daniel and then getting injured, and just understanding that he's not Daniel Woods. And that was a good lesson. It's a good lesson for a bunch of reasons. But there is something there where building your work capacity is really important, and just doing more and more and more, and recognizing that a lot of top climbers climb 6 days a week. It may not be all out, you know, 110% sessions, but if you think about it this way, you know, let's say you are capable of doing one V12 move a session. And you know, that's, you know, like your limit. If throughout the next 6 months, you're able to do two V12 moves in a session and you do it four times a week, you know, you've built up that work capacity to be able to actually display that kind of effort. And I know, you know, it's impossible to say what a V12 move is and different ones, but just the point is if you can create that kind of try hard output and your body can support it, you are building a base to then do a V13 move each session. And so what's mind blowing is looking at these really strong climbers and you see, wow, you know, they did a V16 this day. But boy, if you look back at their last 2 weeks of training, also, they're just consistently climbing. You know, you can call it training, but the reality is they've probably climbed three V14s that week on the spray wall or outdoors or whatever the case may be. And I think we underestimate how much volume goes into these people's workouts. And it's just a reminder that I'm all for resting, and you have to be rested to create a, you know, like a peak performance day. You have to, if you really want to show up to be the best on your project, wherever it is, or have a you know, a limit session, yeah, you need to be rested. But, you know, going back to those kids and what they're doing, you know, do you think that you showing up to the gym 2 hours, 3 days a week is really going to get you to, I don't know, to your goals? And I had a guy message me, his name was Adam, and he wrote me a message that hopefully I can share this. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Someone anonymous sent me an email, and he was getting older and he wanted to climb V12, and he had climbed V10 previously. And you know, the two things I first said to him were, you know, good luck. Don't underestimate how much harder V12 is than V10. And then the next thing I said is, what are you willing to give up to climb V12? And the point being there that you can't do, you know, if you got to V10 doing those three sessions a week, you might have to, you know, step that up to five sessions. And yes, they may not all be max limit, but my point is you have to really put more and more time into climbing to progress. And that's why professional climbers climb so much. So
yeah.
Sorry,
man. If somebody, if somebody had come to me and asked me like, yeah, hey, like, I don't know what this person asked you necessarily, but you know, I climbed a V10. Do you think I climb V12? You know, people do ask me that. My answer is always yes. Like, for sure, dude, 100%. You are capable, you know, a period. And I think like, it's important to not discourage people from the experience, but also like provide that realism that you provide where it's like, but You know, what are you willing to, because if you're not willing to put in the work, you're not going to get it. You know, if you're not willing to accept how hard it's going to be and like what it actually takes, you're definitely not going to get it. But of course you can do it. You know, I really like to start with like, yeah, of course you can, but you know, you probably underestimate how hard it's going to be. And you probably don't even realize what kind of work you need to do to, in order to get that. So all fascinating. I do want to tie this back to Will, a little bit, but, just to wrap up, cause I don't think there's too much that I want to go super deep on. You guys should just listen to the podcast. I did realize after I shared so many JSON notes, I was like, dude, I just like told everybody what the podcast was.
Still worth it.
I'm not going to do that.
Still go and list that JSON podcast.
Yeah. But this one's, you know, fascinating. I think a lot of these things were clearly experiences that Will had that formalized thoughts for him. And, you know, he's coached a lot. And I think a lot of that coaching brought out, you know, noticing that specific things really, really matter in climbing, right? And a lot of things that he was talking about were like the importance of being there and observing to learn, which by the way is, like I told you, a lot of these were repeat concepts for me, something that you say a lot, right? Just the importance of being there. Like, you know, there's a difference between observing through just observing like videos and stuff and being there, trying to do what they're doing and really understanding that, I think was a really interesting concept. He was saying that aside from fundamentals, good technique shines really differently, and figuring this part out unlocks everything for climbers, right? Like he's seen very specific climbers figure out their best way to do their technique. And it's almost like they've become a different person, like their confidence when it comes to solving certain things, or if they fall, they're just like, oh, okay. Like, what do I do now? Right. And it's like, I brought this up as the Nathaniel mentality one time where like, you know, Nathaniel like has a very different set of eyes on the climbing wall, like very relaxed because he knows that he's finding the correct thing versus like checking all of the things and then seeing if the things works. I think he's much more confident where he's like, nope, probably is like this. And if he falls, he still looks confident, right? Tomoa falls and instantly is like, all right, what happened? Like, what do I need to do? Like, what do I have to do? Right. Knowing that the path is there. And I think that comes from fundamentals for sure, but it comes from like very specific techniques that are very specific to people. And you guys had a good conversation about that.
Be more like, have that confidence of Nathaniel Coleman and Tama. Okay, check.
right. Well,
we can move on from Will, but I just had a couple of points on him because I really deeply enjoyed it. I just had such a good time getting to know Will better. And I've known him for a while, but just getting to see him dive deep. I didn't realize how deep he would go. And so I really enjoyed it. And I will take note though, Tim, that you wanted to hear more about his experiences at the shop and seeing those climbers. Cause he is just in such a unique position to share what he's seen about all the different climbers and geeking out on him about the differences between Magos, Sean, Daniel was really fun. And so we'll have Mike again to talk about more of those experiences. And also, Tim, you should go visit there. I thought that was also just interesting where I think we all have that experience, especially when we're younger, of seeing someone do something and showcase that unique ability and then wanting it ourselves. And I just want to commend Will for actually doing that. Like, I think that we all see whoever our climbing hero is and say, ooh, I want that too. But Will like deconstructed it and figured out how to integrate it into his own style. And there's something there that's really cool about Will that's rather than just wanting it, oh, I want to do that too. It's like he said, I want to do it. And then he figured out how to integrate it. And so I just appreciate his ability to go that extra mile and not just say, oh, I want to be strong like Jimmy, so I'm going to do weighted pull-ups. And it's like, yeah, okay. Like 10 more, you'll be just like Jimmy. Good luck. And I also thought it was interesting that he, you know, his company is so helpful in people gaining that raw power. But when you talk to Will, it's about how to integrate that raw power onto the rock, you know, and it kind of showcases him that he created a company that is training focused because he loves training, but he also really understands the role training plays in the grand scheme of things. And I just thought it was funny. He made a comment during the pre-interview about how it's like, if I get one more question about sets and reps, I'm just going to flip out. I'm just going to hang up. Like, so I was like, don't worry, Will, that's not what we're about. But it was a good reminder where you have this guy who is obsessed with training, makes a company around building raw power. And then you read his blog and he says, hey, here's me doing my third V13 in a week. Still can't do a front lever, a one arm pull up, or a one arm hang on a 20 mil. And that's not to say that Will isn't back there busting his butt training. That's the wrong message to take. And I just appreciate that holistic understanding. And yeah, I just, that was important to me, that
yeah,
all of that.
I feel like we do that, right? Like that's a lot of our exact philosophy, like our exact approach. Like we, you know, I like to rave and stuff about like the climbing that I'm doing and you're doing. And like, and then we always talk about how weak our damn fingers are and like
except
the little metrics
that
are missing.
You can do like 10 one arm pull-ups
now, like, but I'm also just, but like, it's crazy to me is that like those things also don't apply to like the thing that I'm doing now that I've learned how to do those things, like one arm pull-ups. And like that stuff just came because I was just a nuthead in the gym too. And like, you know, I did exactly what Will did also. And like in the gym, and I spent a ton of time, like 8-10 hours a day of training to get those little things. And then, you know, when I want to do one arm hangs, I just dedicated like a couple of weeks or months to doing that type of training. And then my body adapted to it. But did it apply to my climbing? Probably not, dude. Like it didn't really feel that much better in any sort of aspect in that way. Not to the point where I saw that many dramatic increases. Like I saw dramatic increases in my metrics and I didn't feel dramatic increases in my climbing ability. And like, that's really the thing that we have to debunk all the time. And you know, it's just so funny, like how often I point to my clients and be like, you guys are stronger. Like you guys are stronger in some ways. And like, that's kind of fascinating as well. But there are very specific ways, very specific aspects of this that we should take to our training and climbing, and just seeing the correlation, I think is fascinating. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, that's great to hear. I mean, that's why it was so fun talking to Will, is I felt like we were just on the same page. And he actually did inspire me to train more though. And I am curious to see how my bout of fingerboarding carries over to my winter climbing scene. And the last thing I wanted to say is just talking to him about the TB2, the new tension board, just how he had a why for every little bit of the creation. And I just, that obsession, it's cool because, I mean, that's climbing. That's what we often talk about. How you grab that tiny little micro crystal so that you get that 0.5% better hold on it as you're doing a crux move is a similar mindset to what he was talking about, where he said, I put a dual tex on this spot, not this spot, because, you know, of this thing versus this thing. And I think that there's some saying, like, how you do anything is how you do everything. And I just appreciated that Will brings that same level of concentration, focus, effort, and attention to detail into all facets of his life. And I think that's, a good thing to strive for in climbing. And of course, you know, everything, but you know, that's how you optimize your whole life around climbing too. Is, you know, I think, totally. I remember Coach Andy kind of talked about that a little bit. You know, I mean, I care about my sleep. I care about my diet. And I know you're still too young to care about that stuff as much, Tim, but you know, you can see.
I care about it. I make the other decision more often.
And I'm not going to critique you for it, but it's that thing that just, every step of the way you care. Like you're not leaving anything. You're not saying, I don't care, I'm too lazy. You're saying, I'm searching for mastery. So I'm going to experiment and try everything. And maybe you put a lot of effort into sleep and you say, hey, it didn't matter for me. But the point was, is that you tried, you say, okay, like I'm going to
totally,
I have a why for everything I do with a known, you know, goal. So I just appreciate that.
That probably was the biggest thing that I respected about Will, just listening to it the whole time. I was like, anything that he talked about in experience was his why, like anything that he was explaining to you or like, you know, you were asking about was like, he's like, yeah. And then there was this, like the story and like this something, it's like, that's the why. And like, I think a common thing that he was talking about was coaching and like learning to learn and like where things come from. And him talking about his experience with Roland, where this kid comes up and is like crying and is like, why won't you tell me the answer? And he, you know, that was his kind of epiphany where he was like, we don't know the answer. Like this kid actually thinks we know the answer, but no, we're just sitting here with you while you find the answer and guiding you through that process. And, you know, for him, that taught him so much. And that I had the exact same experience too, where like kids just want so much. And like the secret as a coach is to explain to them that it is difficult and you just hold your, you know, hold their hand through the difficult process. And then hopefully one day they don't need to hold your hand anymore. Right. And I love that he has the same philosophy as I do, where like, he hopes that you coach somebody as minimally as possible, right?
Yes.
Like as little as possible. Like I want to coach you and then be like, all right, good luck. Like send you off and be like, all right, cool. Like that's all you needed. And I think coaching, first of all, from the consumer's experience is very different. I think a lot of people view coaching as something completely different, see as information, right? A lot of people see coaching and that type of instruction world as information. If I have information and you give me information, then I will be better. I think there's a lot of aspects of information that are great, but context and like, you know, the guidance and honestly, almost the anticipation of something being difficult is the most important part about a coach's experience in their interaction.
Yeah. There's definitely can be a transactional idea where it's like, okay, so if I pay you X amount of dollars, then I will go from V8 to V9, correct? And you go like, no. Oh, they go, oh, but if I pay you this much, then I'll get to V10, right? Like, no, this is not. I want to echo that thing you said where Will had that concept of it's not about how much it's about how little I can coach you. And then release you into the, you know, so that you become your own coach. The master, the student becomes the master. I don't know. I'm just saying, making shit up. Okay. That podcast with Will was one of my favorites. Everyone, you should go listen to it. I think he took the trophy for longest guest, and it was because it was a fantastic one. And also go check out Tension Climbing. I mean, if you know, Will brings that beautiful attention to detail to everything they do there, and it shows. And get their products. I this is not sponsored. Just I, you know, my tape is Tension tape. My hangboard is Tension made, and it's because
it is my go-to hangboard. Yeah. Is the Tension hangboards, but also kudos to making a TB2 because the TB1 was like my least favorite board. Well, it is my least favorite board that exists, but the TB2 is one of my favorites. It's amazing. Mm. Just to go from that, like, okay, like we have this board, we liked it, it was great for our training. And then listening to what it could be, you know, why it could be a little bit better. And it still is the same like concept though. It's the same, like there's still a ton of tension on the wall. It's super aggressive and dynamic, but it's not like nearly as, I don't know. For me, the TB1 was just like way too sharp and like just uncomfortable to climb on. And that's that. Unfortunately, like training is still a climbing experience and we want to make the climbing, but the TB2 is obviously climbing holds and like it's super, super nice.
Good job. Good job, Will. Good job, Tension team. Yeah. Okay. Well, quick little announcement section. Tim, I have to redact something I said. You probably didn't even catch, but yeah, Joe Kinder definitely did not FA Roses and Blue Jays. It was Evan Race. Bryce, if you're out there, you're from back east. You should text me and let me know how wrong I was and give me crap. And yeah, I even looked at 8A and Joe hasn't even logged sending Roses and Blue Jays. So yeah, it's kind of embarrassing. But the reason is Joe is just so freaking prolific with FAs and he's such a good climber that I could make a mistake like that, you know, and I don't feel bad about it because Joe's badass. So just wanted to put that out there because I'm sure I'm going to get some messages. That episode hasn't dropped yet. So that, you know, when we're recording this, that's why I haven't gotten that hate mail saying, Josh, you're an idiot. But so anyways, wanted to correct myself there. And yeah, when this comes out, Tim will already have done another classroom. So please join us for the next one. I guess it'll be in September. Those are really fun. You know, if the classroom isn't for you, but you still want to support us, you can go to Patreon and select a lower tier. Everything helps. We just appreciate it. Really helps us dedicate more time to the podcast and try to, you know, just keep leveling up the podcast, right? Like we're always trying to each week, each month do better and better, get better guests, you know, add more value to more posts, more pro tips, all the things. And your support really helps that. And sign up for our newsletter. I've been sending them out consistently, Tim. I send out the newsletter. You know, usually it consists of pro tips from the latest episode. And it's really fun seeing them written instead of audio. I often kind of edit them a little bit. And there's something really fun about you hear people's kind of stream of consciousness on it, whether, you know, it's Jason Kale or Will Englund. And then actually writing them, I'm like, ooh, that was really good. That's pithy. Good job, you guys. So now you can get them straight in your inbox instead of, you know, listening through the whole episode, although you should do both. That's it. That's all my,
nice.
Those are all my announcements, Tim. You want to go into the, should we do a pro tip? You have a pro tip, Tim?
I have a pro tip.
Okay. Let's hear it.
All right. My pro tip is to experiment more in your climbing. And this could be taken so many ways, so I'll explain. But I have been experimenting a little bit with like advice in climbing, you know, like what is the easiest thing for like one person to hear one thing and like sticks and it actually applies to the climbing, right? Because I have the same thing where I kind of spray and preach certain things, but I do different things and I'm like, all right, what do I actually do? And like on my day to day, I'll pick 15 to 30 minutes of my session. Every session. This is something at least I do every session. I don't do all the warm-up things that I tell my clients every session. I don't do all the things post-session. I probably did as a kid. I would spend, you know, months and years probably every single day doing specific things, but nowadays I don't. But one thing that I do is I still experiment every session that I have, whether it's rock climbing in the gym or somewhere else. I try to pick something stylistically that I wouldn't usually do. Wouldn't do by instinct, like wouldn't do just like if I wasn't thinking about my session. You know, you all know what your sessions look like if you just go in and like do the thing that feels most natural to you. You warm up, you try the climbs, right? But then adding a little bit extra, like a little footwork drill, a little bit extra time on the slab, a little bit extra time on the hangboard, you know, that actually might be a good time for you to hangboard. You know, if hangboarding and fingers and like you don't grab crimps very often, even if you grab crimps all the time and you're recently, literally a week ago, finally got Michaela to, she full crimps everything. I finally got her to start an open-handed half crimp protocol. And she's like, holy, this works. She's like, this is crazy. Like it actually works within like three sessions. She was like feeling so much stronger on the wall. And I was like, it's not about like the strength that you've gained from this. It's just a variety. It's just, you know, she's widening her base for like different things. And so she just started grabbing, you know, three finger drag stuff. I was having her do a finger roll routine. So like at 5-10 minutes at the end of every session, I just have her go on the campus board with her feet on the foot rungs. And she just starts at an open-handed three-finger drag, goes to half crimp, goes to full crimp. And I'm like, you can't do that in your climbing sessions as often. Like most people are trying so hard to send everything and like figure out new problems. It's not like you're figuring out how to balance how many times you grab a three-finger drag and a half crimp and a full crimp on the wall. Like you just happen to grab most likely the thing that you're the best at most of the time. And so it's really important to balance. You know, I've heard a ton of people recently say like, we've been using our thumbs more often because, you know, Josh said that on the pod, it's a great pro tip. Like just use my thumbs more often. I'm like, great. So then pick 15 minutes of your day to be like, I'm going to use my thumbs on all the climbs that I'm going to do from here on out, because you're not going to be as strict about it if you don't have that extra little. So be specific, give yourself some experiments to do from day to day, whether it's dynos, you know, more slopers, more pinching, you know, different variety in crimps, more footwork drills, more slab or whatever it is, experiment. And just add like 15 to 30 minutes of it in your sessions.
Nice. I'm the thumb guy. It's interesting. I can see how you're going to link that pro tip into what we're talking about today. So kudos to slipping that little teaser in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. So I've been on the moon board. Well, I've been off it for a couple of weeks, but I'm just stuck on the moon board, right? Which is very performance oriented, especially just that's how I consider it. I probably shouldn't, but every day I get on the moon board, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do more benchmarks. I'm going to climb those ranks. Right. But it's interesting that you were talking about experimenting, because something I was playing around with was in my warmups actually kind of focusing on something different. So, this was actually pre talking with Will about Daniel Woods. I was kind of Daniel Woodsing on my warmup. I was really locking everything off and just holding that lock off and being super isolating on the moonboard, where typically I would get on and just kind of swing between, especially on the easier climbs, and just kind of, I don't know, just kind of swinging between holds. And then I went the exact opposite. I said, no, I'm going to do absolutely no dynamic movement. I'm going to lock off everything. And it's, and then I also did a thing where I did nothing but big pogos. Like I would just always try to I'm pretty good at using both feet on the move board and making sure I have some opposition there. And I say, okay, I'm just going to try really pogoing during my warm up. And it's cool to hear you echo that, where sometimes just trying something new and embracing, you'll find out, you know, oh, I'm really bad at this. Or, oh, and actually that's what I was kind of surprised is I'm not typically bad at that really hardcore lock-off style, but I haven't been doing it. And it just was a big red flag for me that all of a sudden I'm on the V4 and locking off on the jug felt really hard. And I thought, wow, okay, I need to incorporate this back into my routine. So good tip. My pro tip is not very cool. It's really weird. But I'm just going to toss out there anyways, because I was doing this at a crag and someone just laughed at me and asked me what the hell I was doing. So I figured I'd share it here. Do you know what a food service glove is, Tim? Like a disposable plastic glove?
Just like a regular plastic, like a thin, like plastic glove,
really thin see-through plastic glove. You'll see them like, hopefully when they make your sandwich at Subway, they're wearing these plastic gloves. So my wife had a bunch of these because she doesn't like to get her hands dirty when we're like chopping things up. I don't know. That's her thing. And so I had these plastic gloves, and then I went climbing and I had a bunch of meat and cheese in a bag because that's what I bring for a snack. And one of my old pro tips was to use rubbing alcohol to get that grease off your hands after you've used sunscreen or eaten your greasy, cheesy meal. And so I decided to start bringing food service gloves to eat my meat and cheese. And nice. My buddy just lost it when he saw this. He thought it was the funniest thing ever. And it is funny, but honestly, it's not a bad idea. So now if I pack something that's kind of gross for the hands, and I know I'm going to get my grubby mitts all over it. I use a food service glove. So if you're going to be out there eating a bunch of Cheetos or eating some sausage and some salami, now you can use a food service glove instead of getting your hands all gross and making everyone angry at you when you grab that Crux crimp with your greasy Cheeto hands.
Amazing. Amazing pro tip. Are you one of those people who showered with gloves on?
No, dude. Yeah. No, I'm not a weird glove guy. That was my wife. it just dawned on me. I was chopping because I started doing it. I started using it to chop things up because then you don't have to wash your hands afterwards. And I was chopping up my meat to go to take to the crag. And then I thought to myself, what if I just use my glove to eat too? And there you go.
Genius.
So now I'm the thumb guy and the glove guy.
Genius. Thanks for the actual application. That's what I struggle with, is things to actually bring to apply. But Josh got you.
I'm practical if nothing else.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, that was ridiculous. Do you want to intro the topic, or do you want me to?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, today we're talking about sequencing. I would love to. I love this topic. I think it's fascinating. I think it's super underrated in, you
hold
know,
on, like, say it again. So say it again, make it loud and clear. What's our new segment?
Sequencing. What is sequencing? Why is it important? How do we do it? What is it? What are all the layers? How do we get better at it? You know, sequencing, like I said before, like when we're talking about it, with some of Will's notes, I think the ability to sequence is usually correlated to a climber's max capability in a skill output. Performance output is exclusive to this. I think someone's ability to perform in the moment and bring out the best that they can do is totally different. But if they were to do the best that they can do, I think that best that they can do is solely dependent on their ability to sequence. And I kind of want to go over a concept of macro sequencing and micro sequencing before we go too deep into it, because I do want to, and Josh and I talked about this before the podcast, and it's, you know, kind of why I want to bring this up now, is, you know, I see macro sequencing as all the stuff that we can do off the wall, you know, with our visual information, you know, understanding our logic of why something does what and why we may need something, right? And the micro sequencing is all the stuff that we react to on the wall, right? So all the little choices that we make. And I see those two things as completely exclusive. and your ability to macro sequence. And I actually work with a lot of youth athletes to sequence as best as you can off the wall, but almost always they immediately pull on the wall and do whatever the hell they want to do, right? Even though they're like, oh, for sure, I'll spend so much time like talking about all the things that we should do. And they'll be like, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do this. And sometimes that fourth option is what they actually end up doing that they don't even mention, right? And that micro sequencing ability is, I think, most people's climbing strength. Most people's climbing strength is their ability to intuit on the wall and be like, well, if I grab this, I need this, and then I can do this, right?
You really think that most people are good? I feel like most people aren't good at that. I feel like that's a good thing that kids exhibit often. But you don't want to lean too far on each end.
Compared to their macro, most people are better at their micro, where they pull on and like understand more of like the feel based versus like the knowing of being able to solve just visually. You know, I think people really, really suck at this and like need to practice this concept before they're really good at it. But that's what we're talking about today, is the kind of all things in between, all the little whys, and how did that?
Oh, it's great. I wanted to mention why we're bringing up sequencing today. And I think we kind of alluded to this on the last podcast, that it was a question that we got from Michael in one of our classroom sessions. And it was just good. And we went in deep on it during the session, especially for Michael's, you know, specific sequencing question. But we just kept talking about off air again and again. We're like, man, that topic could just be infinitely deep. And yeah, I liked your breaking up into the macro and the micro, this idea of, you know, that really high level, like, well, that looks like a side pull. Probably going to use that with my left hand. Okay, but maybe I will end up actually taking that, you know, as an undercling if I go this way, and just kind of that sketching that out in like these big, broad brush strokes. And then when you get on the wall, I think this idea of like climbing with intuition when you get on the wall in the micro, I think this shows some of your competition bias, where you're very interested in on that moment, you know, intuiting and learning how to do the subtleties, like right when you pull on, where I think one of my interests in micro sequencing and beta has to do with when you get stopped at crux. And, you know, it's like, what do you do when you get stuck? Like, okay. And Will talked about this, and it's like, do you leave for 6 months or 6 weeks or 6 months to go get stronger and then try to come back? Or do you try to figure out right there and then? And look, sometimes you're going to, you know, if you're a V8 climber and you go get on a V13 with a crux dyno and you just are nowhere near it. Okay. Look, we get it. Like, you need to be stronger, but all, you know, what do you have available to you right there? And, how do you go through these different levels to figure out how to execute in that moment? And so, yeah, I just find it really interesting to talk about the spectrum of, you walk up and you try to understand the basic fundamentals. Okay, I think I'm going to go here with my right hand. And then you recognize, okay, this seems to be the best beta for me. Maybe there's these other options for different people. And we talked about that a little bit, at almost like level two, like understanding the different options and then trying to determine what's best for you. And I'd like, you know, to ask you about how to do that. And then once you've settled on the beta, how do you unlock micro details that may be invisible to a newer climber, but, you know, or maybe kind of like tricks that we've developed in our tool bag over the years. It could be subtle things around hip position. It could be getting a little knee scum. It could be finding focusing on finger position. So just, I thought that is just a really interesting thing of going through that journey where it starts with basic fundamentals. And even though we go down deep, it still has to connect to that basic fundamentals. And yeah, so it's almost an infinite layers we can peel there.
Totally. But there's so many different, I love that you know, brought it back to Michael, who was a client that I coached for a while, and he's really deep diving on this hunt on the moon board as well. And, you know, his question, and it's a question that I get asked a lot, almost every coaching experience, this will come up in some aspect, which is, how did you find that answer? Right? Like, a lot of people will, you know, I really hate solving people's problems, like people's climbing problems on Zoom calls and stuff like that. I really hate finding the sequence and telling you the answer. And I almost never will unless it's like the point isn't doing the climb, like unless the point's something else. And that's often when it'll come up, but I'll just be like, okay, just to expedite this process, here's the beta. Here's like the best beta I see, right? And like, here's what I think is the best beta, right? And try it. And they'll be like, holy shit, like how I would never have seen that. I would never have thought about this, right? I'm like, great, it's fine. It's totally fine, right? And they're gonna be like, no, but it's not fine. Like that's what I wanted. Like what I wanted was the ability to do what you just did, not to climb the climb, but to find the best way. And I'm like, okay, all right, cool. Like that's interesting. You know, like I definitely was like that as a kid. Like, you know, the most important thing for me was really knowing what all the best ways were, because I would usually go to a competition, try my absolute best and be like, this is the best way. And I try and try and try and then watch the next competitor do it a better way. And I'm like, what the dude, like, that's crazy. Like, I never would have thought that. Like, that's insane. Like, what is wrong with me that I get here and I can't even see it? And I'm like, okay, it's not actually a thing that I learned this discovery over time. It's not actually that, like, there's anything wrong with me. It's not that I'm missing anything, you know, necessarily, but I'm not practicing enough in the sessions. Like, I'm not trying enough. Like, I haven't had enough experience. And this is really where, in my opinion, time is super relevant, but also your intention is, you know, the graph there is going to be correlated to the exact amount of intention that you put in whatever climbing situations you have. And then that goes into all the little variables that we're going to talk about, but then also the amount of that you're doing and the amount of time that you have doing that stuff. And the reason why that's significant is because, you know, the core concept of sequencing for me is your opinions and your belief, right? Something that you've also heard me talk about in coaching is, you know, someone's core ability in climbing is also dependent on their opinions and their belief of what do you think is possible, right? Because when you and I look at the climbing wall and some random, you know, other V7 climber looks at the climbing wall and you and I say, yeah, you can just grab this, put your foot there and grab this and then turn your body and reach that, right? Like I tend to sequence a little bit better with climbers who are stronger, right? Because I just don't sit there and argue with like what's possible. I hate going to comps and like if for lead comps, we have this preview time and there's like 6 minutes and I'll just be like, yeah, grab that, step on this, move this, right? And they're like, you think you could do that? I'm like, I'm not even going to sit here and like talk about if I think I can do that move or not. Like there's certain situations that I cannot read because there's so many options and there's so many like where I find it hard to read things for me. Sorry, this is a tangent, but where I find it really hard to read things for me is when all the sequences look about the same difficulty, not when sequences look super, super difficult. If a sequence looks super, super difficult, it's actually really easy to sequence, right? You're like, well, you probably just go for it and you stick it, or you probably do something completely different. When there's four or five or six different possible sequences in three movements, that's when it gets really intricate. And that's why I think competitions are fascinating, because route setters are really good at doing that, right? But, you know, our theory for in that moment, like what's the best, changes from climber to climber based on our experiences, right? Based on our training, based on our strength, but mostly based on our experiences. I know climbers who are extremely strong and have terrible opinions. Like their correlation to their actual, you know what I'm saying? Like their actual ability of output and their potential output 100, 500 tries deep. And then their first try understanding what they think they're capable of are like miles apart, right? And you'll usually see that person not flash things. Like, and sometimes it's kind of strange where the person will perform really well. That's why I think those two things are very exclusive. Their ability to find the logic, but also perform. Those are completely external, you know, exclusive things in rock climbing. And you do have to work on both those things. And a lot of our podcasts have talked about the performance aspect, the mentality aspect, the mindset aspect. But what about the logic? What about why do you step on that foot versus another? Why do you, when you're drop kneeing, have to turn deeper and hold timing and freeze certain parts of your core for longer in order for the drop knee to stick? You know, why do you have to adjust that foothold, 2 inches further right to make it a better drop knee, right? And that's where like I find rainbow climbing and spray wall climbing so fascinating. And like, you know, stick point drills are, in my opinion, the best lead climbing drill, because you just point the handholds for somebody and say, you can step on whatever you want to step on. But you have to make sure your number one goal in the stick point drill is to stick the next move by the best, right? That's the point of this drill, meaning you have infinite foot options, infinite foot variations, right? You can literally move your feet millimeters at a time and it'll make a difference, right? And you can also time your movements differently. And I just see there's so many different little theories and logic in our actual mechanical movements that have an effect on our ability to climb, obviously different than our performance aspects. And I think that's the stuff that we need to get better at. How do we get better at it? We can go down that rabbit hole, but I think that's what makes this whole sequencing conversation so fascinating is this is how we get better at climbing. This is a huge aspect of how we get better at climbing.
Yeah, it makes me think of some of the stuff Will talked about with perspective and seeing climbers do something an entirely different way than you even thought was possible. And I would say that some of my issues with sequencing is you talked about when there's a bunch of different ways. And what is tricky for me is that I have certain strengths that are quite a bit larger than my weaknesses. You know, like my weakest weakness is quite a bit far from my strongest strength. And so this is where I struggle and I get into trouble, is I'll often see a way that is clearly harder, but I think I can do. And then this is what's interesting, is having to decide which one to pursue. And some, you know, you talked about the spray wall and making up problems. And this is where it's been really helpful for me climbing with other climbers that have different strengths than me, is that when they set a problem and I'm forced to do a move in a style that I would not choose, that I would bypass or do something that is technically harder, but is easier for me, you gain this proficiency in a style and understanding of what's possible. And then when I look at that, a sequence that has that as an option and my technically harder one that I usually would find easier, I get more inclined to say, you know what, I'm going to use that small crimp in that big foot rather than, you know, jump to the large edge that's way further, because I just know that I can actually do it that way. It's not so bad. And this is where, so yeah, you know, we were talking about these different levels. There's just understanding right, left, right, left, right. Although I will say, even though that's like level one, I am amazed at how many times you take people climbing and they just don't grab the hold like you think they're going to grab it. I don't think that's the people listening to this podcast, but it just blows my mind where I'm like,
well, we've all been there.
Yeah. Sort of. You know, it's like if you took someone to a ladder and you're like, how did you end up with your left hand on the the route's most right hold? Like you somehow got way off base, like, and I just don't understand. But anyways, so there's level one there. And then level two is this thing we're talking about with seeing all the options and then having a good idea around which one is technically the most efficient or easiest theoretically, and then integrating your understanding of your own ability and then picking that solution. And then when you get on the wall, you know, adapting in the moment, that's more to me, that's more of a competition or flashing mindset, Tim. And I will say that this is where you see that the best climbers able to really understand what's going to work right from the get-go and be able to execute it. I guess I'd like to hear more from you about how, you know, I kind of told you about my experiences where I see both ways, or I see three ways, and I know which one I'm more drawn to. And, you know, like, how do you make that decision about which one to then try to execute on?
Love that stage setting. And I want to kind of go more into that, like levels that we were just talking about. You know, there is like a level one sequencing is, you know, what should I do? Like what's the best that I can do? Right. Like just imagine you put on your V1 glasses, guys, like everyone put on their V1 glasses and grab the star hold and be like, all right, dope. Like I got that foothold and somebody told me I have to follow the color. So, okay, cool. Like I got to follow all the blue holds. Cool. So I can step on that one. I can step on that one. Dope. I can reach that one. I guess I'm just going to reach that one. Right. Once I reach this one, I'm like, oh, kind of need my foot up. Like I kind of need my foot up. Right. So that's like level one sequencing.
That's not what V1 people do though. I did not think, oh, I need my feet up. That's like the last thing.
Sprawl out. Well, yeah. Once they're like fully reached out and maxed, they're like, what do I do now? It's like, okay, you can move your foot. Right. And then you can move your hand. And maybe if you're a little bit more advanced with the level one sequencing, you know, certain allowances, right. You know, certain like, yeah, if I turn this way, if you have a good teacher, someone can tell you like, if you turn, you can reach more, right? If you step with your right foot, you can reach further with your right hand and yada yada, right? There's this level one sequencing.
Let's stop picking on level. Everyone here is much right. Past that, but it is still mind-blowing to me that just like, yeah, I watch my kids climb up the stairs and they do it better than, you know, athletic adults taken to the gym the first time. And I don't know. One of my biggest pet peeves is the always a twisted climber too, you know, like the one who's always stepping on the outside of their foot, like always. And you're like, dude, you could just open your, you know, you could.
Yeah, there's certain square positions anyways, that are far more effective.
Okay, we're totally just ripping on people that don't even exist. I'm sorry. Okay, go on.
Level two sequencing is kind of what you were just talking about, where you can observe all of the best options and truly understand what the best options are for you, right? Even though there might take more physical effort, which is something that I love that you said, it's okay because you're going to be more successful in that. Why? Because you know the other technique options that are available to you, not the ones that you can do, period, but the ones that are available to you on this climb, whether you saw them or not, right? And you think that you are going to succeed on them less than this, you know, more physical option. That's okay. I think that's a more confident way of climbing. And like, that's going to be far more effective for most people. If you know that this way is better for me, even though it takes more physical effort, that's probably the way you want to go towards. Level three sequencing, in my opinion, becomes a little bit more about the anticipation of all the things that might take you off, all of the variables that might take you off of climbing, right? So there's a lot of things that we can do in climbing. There's a lot of things that are going to take us off of climbing, and really understanding those variables, I think, is like the infinite depth. The example would be if I am heel hooking a move and I'm going, maybe not so good of an example. Maybe like there's a couple of foot options where I'm over a lip and I either have my feet underneath me and that those foot options allow me to jump a little bit better, or I have a really high foot that's worse, but I can go a little bit slower on the movement. Well, what's the handhold that I'm going for? What direction is it facing? Is it blocked? Right. Those are a couple of things that I'm looking at. And if I can generate really quickly and, dynamically with these lower feet, but what do I need? Well, if the hold is blocked, I don't want to jump. I want accuracy. So how do I provide accuracy? And then, picking all these things that are going to cause me to fall if I jump with this weight. It's not necessarily just because you see there, if I go with the level two approach, I'm like, sure, I can jump. And for me, it's always easier to jump and I'm way more controlled and I'm going to be more accurate jumping. It's like, well, we're not necessarily going into all the bad properties of jumping, right? What about the good properties of this higher, more static foot? It's like, well, it's a worse foot. You know, I totally see people being like, well, it's just a worse foothold. I'm worse at using this worse foothold. It's like, well, but even though you are able to use this hold like 6 out of 10 and this other method 10 out of 10, if the 6 out of 10 method is far more effective for all the variables that you're seeing about this movement and you're understanding that you're going to fall because of other things, it's just better to go with the 6 out of 10 method, even though you're worse at it, right? Because it's just a better movement. And that takes sequencing. It takes understanding that certain things are going to happen. You have to understand logic in climbing. You know, if I grab this, this is going to happen. If I step on this, it's going to happen. And basically go ahead.
I was just going to say, to me, what you're talking about there is a more holistic view of the climb than just the move. You're like understanding, how to set yourself up for success on the next move. Or it's just like that example of that blocked hold. Like that's a classic one where you're like, yeah, no, I could just launch to it, but I can't quite get it good. And so you ever have that thing where you can get the hold, but you can never quite get it right. And you get sucked into this, like, you're like, no, but I'm all over it. It's like, you're not, dude. Like you're actually not.
I think the first time I kind of ran into this concept was paddle dinos. I remember the first time I saw a paddle dino, I thought it was fascinating because I was like, oh, wow. It's the concept of paddle dino is that you can't control the first one, the first hole that you're jumping to. So you use that hold to get to another one, right? And you see constantly when you're teaching people paddle dinos, that people generally like don't understand that at all. So they don't even like approach their trajectory and like their landing position and the timing of it. In a way, and trajectory and landing position, you know, end position is really the most important things when it comes to doing some, you know, coordination paddle dino movements in general. But also people just don't think about that concept. So what they do is they try to just jump to the first hold, right? They don't realize that you cannot stick the first hold, right? If a paddle dino is set appropriately, that's a big, big if there, right? And how do you set a paddle dino appropriately? Don't make it possible to control the first one, right? The goal there is to use this because you cannot stop on this first one. Why can't you stop on this first one, right? Like, and that's for us, that's the whole sequencing thing, right? It's like you see in competitions constantly, like 8 out of 10 paddle dinos, people break them. The person stops on the first hold. People stop on the paddle hold, right? Because they're so good. You see Tomoa do this all the time. He stops on whatever he wants to stop on and he creates something. Either he lands in the position in a different trajectory. He kicks his foot on the wall. He, you know, uses some other flip hand or something. He creates whatever that doesn't make sense in order to do something that the setter didn't necessarily intend because he sees it as easiest. He sees it as the most effective. Anyway, I just thought that this, like, yeah, the way that you solve should be a holistic view because you're not going to be able to see those little occurrences that might cause failures, right? And then you're not making proactive decisions to prevent those failures from happening. I think that's level three sequencing, right?
So I, you know, we're just making up these levels as we go along, but you know, it is just showing that you can keep peeling the layers of the onion off. And I don't know if this is going to be level four, but to me, this is an area that I just find really interesting. And that's, you know, more along these lines of, you know, micro sequencing or whatever we want to call it. And it's when you get stopped and you are confident in the sequence, you're committed to a sequence. You say, okay, I'm going to use this foot and these hands. And then you just get stopped on the move. And you're like, okay, I can't quite reach it, or yeah, I'm generating, but I'm not generating enough, or I can't quite latch it, whatever the case may be. And I guess I wanted to have that discussion about what's the thought process that you undergo when you get stopped at a crux move. And I can share some of mine. I think one of the cooler ones I did, I look cooler just because the route was cool, was my Loscott Dyno, you know, explanation, where I kind of basically did a three-step sequence of, this didn't work. And so my next try, I tried this and that didn't quite work, but it got better. And then I tried this and that didn't quite work. It got better. And I added all those together in a coordinated fashion, because each thing was what I thought was the, I'll call it like the lowest hanging fruit, or the biggest return on investment for tweaking, to help me stick that dyno. And, you know, then I started stacking micro beta, you know, detail. And then the tricky part is putting those all together and executing that move. And it's, I guess the reason why I think it's important is that I think that some of those things that I explained that were details are things that were hard won over the years. Like one of the simple ones, but it's not that simple, was to pull in when you dyno. And you know, I'm just using that as an example. Pulling in when you dyno lets you stay closer to the wall, so when you jump, you don't launch far away, you know? And of course, it's like one of the most basic dyno techniques, but you know, if you just start dynoing, you don't know that pulling in close to the wall is important. And so I could explain some of the other ones, but I guess what I'm trying to do is help people shortcut this process of the idea of like pulling in close for dynoing was just, I don't know, man, I probably climbed for 5 years and did a million dynos before I really understood that that was maybe the most crucial part for dynoing, was jumping as close to the wall as you can without banging your face, you know, to get that distance. And, you know, that's for really big, large dynos, but we can start, you know, we can start talking about all those little details and orientations of hips, or how to heel hook, or, you know, what to try first when you get stuck. But I just kind of wanted to hear your process. Like you're on a crux, you're on Trieste, and you find out like, oh geez, man, like this like big bump move is just stopping me. And, you know, I guess you can, it would be cool to hear how you think about maybe then adjusting your most basic sequence, and then your commit, you say, no, this is the one for me because of X, Y, and Z. And then what's the micro adjustment? What's the micro sequence details that you go through in your head, so that we can help people make visible what may be invisible to them right now in their career?
I will say that you're asking the question that coaches hate hearing, because that's like you're trying to ask a question to get this impossible answer, right? So I'm just gonna
no. Okay, okay, I don't want to derail you too much, but actually my goal is my concern is that we're trying to.
Yeah, it's too complex.
Yeah, it's like too complex. So like, yeah. What's like the first principles? Like, where do you, I mean, it's really hard to describe. It's a really hard topic because it's
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Just, yeah, I'm not asking you for specifics, but sometimes the specifics are good because they're literally invisible to people. They never even had the conception that that could be part of
it. I'm not saying I'm not answering the question. I'm just saying that there is no one answer to the question, right? So yeah. I'll share it, but it's a really important caveat because, you know, this is, I feel like people are just going to like lean in and be like, yeah, what's the answer, Tim? Like, what's the answer? And like, or what's the answer, Josh? And
they're
like
just crying on the other side. Why won't you tell me, Tim?
We are here. Right. Exactly. But like, no, that's why I'm picking on you for it, because it's like, don't ask me for one answer because it's not going to be one answer, right? Like, that's what I'm trying to say. And like, it's a lot of answers. It's a lot of different thought processes here. And, you know, that's why I kind of separate it in like macro and micro, because I think a micro is what you're talking about, that experience of like in the moment, in the wall, like what decisions do you make over time? And, you know, based on my experience, yeah, I can tell like over 100 tries, like what is going to end up being my most ideal beta? Probably. But that's over my time, over my thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of attempts on different things. And then my micro is decided by that. It really is. It really is decided by my opinions. So if you want to expedite that process, essentially you have to get stronger opinions in less time. Is that possible for you? That's up to you, right? That's up to you to decide, is this crimp good enough to do this move? Is this drop knee good enough to do this movement? Is this good enough for me to keep it for this amount of time, right? And those are, and then, sorry, that second part, all that saying good enough for what? Do you even know what you're good enough for? Do you even know what the movements, what do you have to be good enough for to stick this movement? So there's two different parts there, right? Is like understanding what good enough for you is, but also understanding what are you even looking for that needs to be good enough, right? So that's why it's complex. And that's why climbing is so fun, because there's so many different scenarios in rock climbing. There's so many different positions, so many different movements to unlock, right? And so the first step is, yeah, truly just discovering and, you know, finding your opinions and seeing what, you know, works and what doesn't work. So that's just trying a lot of stuff, right? And then once you try certain things, answering that next question, what do you need, right? What do you need and why, I think is the next biggest question is, you know, do you need distance? Do you need to create distance for this movement? That's a totally different, you know, aim for setting up for movements. Do you need to maintain this lower body lock, you know, to make sure that you know, have something else? You know, what are the little variables that are different? Like, what's weird about this hold? What's weird about the direction of this one? What's weird about the distance between these two holds and the next one, right? And those are all the little questions that I ask myself in the moment that make me look for different little things that I can do with my body, right? I'm not looking for what I like doing with my body. I like looking for what I can do, right? And what's possible. And then over time, that's where that first step kind of adjust over time, which is what is possible that I'm capable of doing, right? So first I look for what do I need, then what can I do? And that's through a lot, like I think people just lack the ability to be creative in the moment. If they're struggling, they just lack the ability to be creative. What can you do with this hold? If I ask any V6 climber, what could you do with all the holds on the nest? And they'd be like, fucking nothing. Like, basically nothing, right? And so for me, I'm like, no, I can do this. I can move my foot here. I can turn my body this way. I can go faster. I can go slower. Like, I can do so much. And because I can do so much, I can answer my question, what do I need, with from so many different stances, right? And I think that's, you know, the more stances you have to be able to answer that question, what do I need based on what I have, then you can truly find the little sequences that work and you can be more confident in them. Is that like,
I totally get it. I totally agree. And this is why it's so important to just climb and see others climbing. It helps your creativity. I think what I want to do, just to be as practical as possible, is I'm going to just try to like run through some examples using stuff you talked about, where it's, what do I do if I can't reach, you know, I can't generate, like I'm dying and I can't generate. Or I think another good example we could go through is the hold I'm moving to is very, very small. And so I need to go more static. This idea of being creative really does come from exposure to different types of climbing, different people. And actually, just as you were talking, it made me think of this. You've done Xavier's Roof, right? Yeah, you must have done Xavier's Roof. So Xavier's Roof has like
V11.
Dude, mine too. My first double digit. And you do this lock off from a good left hand with a high foot, or is it a high foot? A decently high foot or a toe. I don't know. And you grab this right hand side pull crimp. And then what people do often is they get a really high right foot and they mantle off of their left hand and kind of pop to a jug with their right hand. So you end up kind of mantling off your left hand. But when it got done by Sean McCall first, is he locked off that right hand and went left hand to the jug. So he did not mantle. And those two moves are so freaking different. Like they are just completely different, but the foot is the same. The hand is the same. Both hands are the same and the finishing jug is the same, but it's, you know, which hand did you go up? And, it's funny because whoever came up and did it, the mantling, I mean, it knocked at least a full grade off of that climb, by doing it like that. And, you know, Sean is just, boy, was he on one back then too. That was a long time ago and he could just crimp like a champ.
Yeah, that's so, actually also, sorry, I'll interrupt you. Interesting point. When you do sequences on a specific rock climb and the sequences happen to be easier, that's how downgrades happen, is when people just find better ways to do the same assortment of holds and then we can just downgrade a climb.
I wonder if Sean, he's a little bit on the shorter side and he is also an incredible crimper and strong guy. I wonder if he would struggle to do the mantle way because it's a little bit spanny. You know, it's just interesting. Yeah. So I wonder if like that was the easier way for him. But I guess I just kind of wanted to run through some of my thoughts on how to get stopped by a move and how to just start deconstructing it. And, you know, it always comes down to these fundamentals of, you know, I need to make a big move outright. And so you just ask yourself, okay, I can't quite reach it. Or, I mean, one of the best things about video analysis is to actually see what's going wrong. Okay, are you really not making the distance? Okay, when you go for that hold, is your hand blowing? Like maybe the hand that is holding on for that big move as you're reaching is blowing before you're getting the distance. And then you might say to yourself, oh, okay, well, I need to pull in more. And so you really find a better way to hold that left hand. And then if it still blows while you're trying to pull your hips in to jump for that next hold, now you have to say, okay, well, am I utilizing that hand hold to the best way it can be? So it's maybe it's a side pull. And so then you, as you're jumping, maybe you head to the right. Or sorry, you know, assuming it's a left side pull, you try to use your body and feet to go to the right to give yourself a line of pull on the side pull that's the best it can be to get you as close to the wall to then launch off your feet to get that distance. And you go, okay, like that's working, but I'm still not generating quite enough. And so then you start looking at your feet and understanding, okay, am I mainly jumping off of my right foot? Okay, great. Am I in the position for jumping with my right leg that's optimal? And if it's not, then you need to look at your left leg and how it can help you generate to get over that leg to generate. And, you know, I guess the thing is you want to look at the actual movement and then you want to look at your points of contact on the wall and try to optimize them. And then you want to start deconstructing the coordination of them to optimize each bit to still come back to that fundamental of jumping to the next hold. And I mean, I can keep going down these layers, but I guess, you know, and you don't have to do this, Tim. I guess it's fun to kind of pick a few scenarios or times you've been in that position and just share how you actually tackled that specific issue. And I'm hoping that by doing that, we're getting to some first principles, instead of just solving the problem for people. Cause it really is. I mean, this is the fun thing about climbing is, you know, literally every climb is different. And when Sean did Xavier's, maybe he did say, oh, this could be mantled. I can't mantle it. So I'm going to do it like this. You know?
Yeah. The reason why I think I'm shying away from like giving actual experiences is because for me, that's not necessarily the point. Like, I think there's a much broader concept in you explaining like, you know, all the little operational mechanics, like, and I'm going to go into that because I think it's fascinating. Like, I love how you're describing like the exact things, how to interact with what you're already doing, right? Because I think probably 90% of the time that I see someone in a client in a session and they say they fall in a movement, they're like, okay, what did I do wrong? And I'm like, well, what you did itself was correct, but we used that incorrectly, right? It's exactly what you're saying. So there is a lot of aspects like that. 90% of the time, it's probably that, right? So for you guys listening, if you're falling on a movement, 90% of the time, in my experience, it's probably that you're incorrectly using what you're already doing, right? Unless you're already a professional climber.
Dude, plus one to that. I don't want to interrupt that too much, but what you said right there, I think you said in a way that I was really trying to get at, where
right.
you're already doing the move and you're doing it, but now we need to line up all the parts and totally. Optimize all those bits, because you have it, but you just haven't linked it right. all together. Okay.
And cool. that's why I don't want to use experiences, because I think when you're listening to experience, it's hard to like correlate that to like exactly what's happening. I think what's happening is that you are incorrectly using what you're already doing. That's why I think the word mechanics is really fascinating to me. Are you maximizing mechanics? Are you maximizing the operation of mechanics, right? So if you are doing like this big rock over on this foot, are you pulling on that hand for the entire time of that movement? Is your knee cranked over that toe the entire time? Is that toe even flexed the proper trajectory? You know, is your other foot helping? Is there momentum added or taken away that's going to have a very specific impact on the movement? You know, are you operating on, you know, the points of contact on the wall, are those being operated appropriately? That's what Josh asked. And I think that's the very first place to ask ourselves. And by the way, no matter how much you correct this, you are probably never going to get to the correct answer. There's just another really big caveat there. You know, as professional climbers, as really strong climbers, even us, we are, you know, trying movements 100 times and I'm still like, can I do this better? Like literally 100 tries deep, I'll be like, can I do this one movement that I've been trying 100 times? I think I could do it better. Like, I think there's better ways to do this exact same movement that I'm doing over and over again. And if we're not asking ourselves that, then I think that's the first place we should stay.
Well, and that's why I really want to emphasize it's infinite. And something that is tricky is that sometimes I'll figure out maybe three details that I can do better, and then I do them, but then it's that connecting them all together and actually doing them all at the same time. You know, I you have to ask yourself, do I need to find one little iota better way to place my foot on this foothold that's sloping a weird way? Or do I need to connect all these three things I did and execute on them together? Because that becomes really difficult, where you have eight things to do correctly, but then putting them all into sequence. It's something that always blows me away with good comp climbers, is when they figure out a move and then they never drop it again. And that is not me. I mean, I will say that sometimes I just get climbs on lock or whatever, right? You just go, wow, like now this move feels easy. But I don't know if I'm one of those people who does a crux move and then never falls on it again. You know, that's...
There was the story of like me running into Dave Wetmore after I did the Side of Paradise in the Buttermilker Cave. And we kind of walked in and just were, you know, hanging out, talking shit. We were friends and Brennan was there. And, you know, so I just was like, yeah, I was like, Buttermilker is one thing that took me like 8 sessions to send. And now I can do it first try every time. Like, it's just a climb that I feel like I can do that with. And Brennan was like, you couldn't do Buttermilker first try right now. I was like, I'll go get my shoes and prove to you I could do it first try. And Dave was like, I would love to see that. And I did it first try. And, you know, what I was doing there was understanding.
Did you get beer?
Yeah. I won so much, dude. I got a medal and nothing. I got literally nothing. But, you know, I got to prove a point where I was like, I just understand all the things that are going to make me fall about Buttermilker. And I make all these proactive steps in the moment to make sure that those falls don't happen. You know, and like, yeah, I might slip and bad things might happen, but I'm doing all the good things to make sure that I'm sticking movements and that I'm sending. And I just understand what those good things are relative to the things that are going to spit me off. For example, on Buttermilker, like the notorious move that you would probably fall on if you're trying to like do this climb first try is that bump move, right? Or the first move to that pinch, where like on the stand start, you start with this horrendous undercling and the feet are a little bit too far away from you and you're dropping this foot that's like just terrible and like not facing the right way. The push foot's really bad and you're reaching as far as you can to this like blind pinch thing. And then you bump to another blind hold. And I just know how to line up my forearm to the wall to like know I'm never missing that move. So I've just mimed it enough times to know exactly where I aim my forearm to just mash this tick. And then when I grab, like I know how to like turn my body in a way to freeze at a specific time. So I feel like I have infinite time to like grab these holds accurately. Holds that you should have a lot of accuracy. So when people say like, yeah, you just got to be more accurate. You got to be more precise. Okay. How do you actually provide more accuracy? How do you actually, what do you focus on to provide more accuracy? That's a concept that a lot of people struggle with. Try to answer that question in your sessions. Okay. I want to be more accurate. How do I provide more accuracy? What are all the little factors here? What are all the mechanics that I can control, that I can focus on in the moment, that I can improve on to provide more accuracy? Instead of saying, be more accurate next time, look at the hold and like actually grab it, you understand climbing very little. You don't understand that certain decisions and certain timings will affect that accuracy. And you have to be proactive in that moment to make sure you provide more accuracy for yourself.
Yeah, that's an interesting example of this idea of accuracy, where there are certain moves where you need to be really accurate, but the way that you get accurate is to do the move so you end up in this, your body is in this certain position that's really up high and in the right position, and then you go for the hold versus I'm just going for the hold. It's like, no, going for the hold is the last part. You need to get into the right position to give yourself the extra, you know, quarter of a second to then find that hold well. And yeah, see, this is the kind of stuff that, I don't know, I just wish we could help make it more visible for people, because, and I do not have it all figured out. And one of our tips was just, I don't want to say banging your head against the wall, but it kind of is just really having that time on the wall, trying different things, seeing what works for other people. And, you know, you just kind of, it's hard won. And I really like that, that sequence I talked about with Loscott, because the feet I was using and the hands I was using are exactly what everyone uses. So there's no, like, there was no, there's nothing for anyone to tell me in a way. It's like, oh, well, Josh, did you grab those crimps? Yeah, I did. Oh, well, then didn't you just dyno and grab it? And I did not. And I did not even get close on my first try. But then, you know, within, you know, the 5 days or whatever, I did it. And I dunked it when I did it too. Like full on, just like it was nothing. And there's no way, I did not get stronger. Like, but, you know, I kind of, you know, talked through that I've done it a few times. So I don't want to go deep into it. But, you know, just my kind of like stacking of different skills that I knew from the past, you know, pulling in close, standing up, oh no, you know, jumping really hard. Okay, I still did not get enough weight on that foot. So kind of coordinating that move onto that foot to jump and pull in. And it was just like, I can imagine someone who was in over their head on that dyno just pulling in and jumping, you know, pulling and jumping, and then saying, wow, like that is really far away. And they may have a way higher vertical leap than me or way higher crimp strength than me, but it was that ability to stack those details so that I ended up really in the right position. And so I'm just trying to think of if there's any other tips we can give.
I'll try to tackle this. I wrote a lot of little like actual logistical tips to kind of go into. I'm not struggling to answer this question necessarily. I do think that it's a concept that we haven't fully figured out as like rock climbing is kind of what you're saying, Josh, but I have coached this a lot. This is like the biggest thing that I coach, and I'll try. But like I said before, there's no one answer, and you will probably not listen to this podcast and immediately get better at it, but I'll give you a framework to start thinking about things and looking at things so that you can go into your next session and start getting better at this, because I am still getting better at this. And I will always continue to get better at this.
Always.
When I think of, you know, when you were talking about Jimmy Webb as someone who seems to have pretty much linearly grown, I feel like I get better at climbing every day, Josh. I don't know about you, but every day I go in session, I feel like I can choose to increase my ability as a rock climber, whether it be physical, whether it be mental, whether it be technical, and technical being sequential. I think like these types of things are technical aspects of rock climbing. So we said this a couple of times earlier, but I think sequencing is really like, in line with the word logic, just climbing logic and climbing theory, like truly knowing what climbing is, you're using logic, your logic that you already have or logic that you're discovering to make sense of efficient choices for one, right? You're trying to see what actually that word optimal and that word efficient, I think is, you know, something that is in core behind the scenes in everyone's climbing language, right? We want to be efficient. We want to be optimal all the time. We want to do the best. So you're using logic to find and make sense of efficient choices. So not necessarily to find those efficient choices, but you're making sense of them. How to best generate, whether that's with momentum, whether that's with, you know, slow drive or using your foot or using your arms, you're trying to use logic to find out how to best generate. Why you may need opposing hand or foot placements. That's a really big one. I think people don't necessarily understand the impact of barn doors and like swings side and side. So opposition is sometimes extremely important. When all three holds are facing the exact same direction, you can create opposition in unique creative ways, right? When you need more or less speed, That for me is a really big concept. Why do you need more speed? Why do you need less speed? And how do you change that? I think that's where logic can come. And it usually comes for me off the wall first and then on the wall, right? I have my off the wall logic where I look at the climb and I'm like, okay, I see all these things that could occur. I see all these things that I could do. And truly knowing those certain decisions, I think, and truly knowing why those certain decisions affect others, truly knowing how to use strength, body positioning, momentum, timing, it can actually allow for optimal choices in climbing, right? Truly understanding those aspects. And at the end of the day, for me, sequencing is a way to best solve climbing math. So for me, those are concepts that kind of add up to your climbing math. And we've talked about climbing math a little bit before, but, you know, seeing if it's worth taking from a place, from, you know, another foot or from another hand, or, you know, going faster instead of going slower is something that I was mentioning before, in order to fill a gap elsewhere. Like, should we release this toe hook and preset a foot before we go for the move? You know, should we turn the knee and then, you know, grab this hold and then kick our foot, you know, over there, or walk our foot slowly? Like, why should we do those things, right? And there's logic and there's ways to explain why one thing is better than another, but our ability to solve those things and use that climbing math is, you know, that's the underlying beauty of sequencing, right? It's, yeah, it's not just, you know, the concept here isn't get better at sequencing and understand, like, those are all little things that I pay attention to in order to sequence better and to use my sequences better. But the point is for me to have better climbing math, is to decide, okay, if I'm going to generate for this movement in three different ways, which one is best, right? If I'm going to do eight different movements to send this entire V10, what are the best eight movements to spend my climbing math the most appropriately, right? Like, should I grab this hold and then kick my foot super high up there so I can skip this other sequence? You know, should I just jump to this hold so I don't have to, like, tic-tac and then flip my hand the other way and unwind? Should I go here and then unwind, even though it's three extra moves? Is it less effort to do those three extra moves? And there's so many different scenarios in climbing that it's impossible for us to go in and say, like, okay, when you see this, you should do this. That's not the point. The point is not to say this is right, this is wrong when you see this. No, you're going to see a bunch of different climbing opportunities. You're going to see a bunch of different positions and scenarios and choices that you have. And your ability to use your logic over time that you've formed from opinions, from, and this is why we make all those little things about, like, when you fall, like, have a specific process. When you have friends, use your friends. Why? Because it all comes down to this point. When you're sequencing and, you know, when you're on the one climb, on the one attempt, all those things will come crashing down onto you in that one moment. And your ability to use all the experiences that you have in that one moment and make a better choice. And that word better is going to be different for everybody. But in my opinion, if you always are trying to do the best that you can do and always try to be better, you're always going to slowly adapt towards that. And you're just going to get better that way. You may fail and you may make a mistake in that moment. But if you're always trying to do my best in that moment and then decide afterward objectively why that was actually good or bad, right? That's a huge one, right? Say, okay, this foot right in front of me, if I just dyno for this hold, is the best way, right? And we do this constantly, right? We're like, that's for sure the best way. And then we try it. And then we ask, I think, you know, with humility and say, is this actually the best way? Like, hey buddy, like, you know, you just watched me. Did that look like the best way to you? Like, you know, you can either trust other people and finding their logic based on what they just saw, or use your logic before, during, and after. Film yourself. That's a huge one to see, like, yeah, you know, Josh made a great point. Like, did you fall in the move? Why did you fall in the move? What came off first? People are horrendously bad at this, by the way. All of you listening, we're all horrendously bad at this. To say exactly what truly happened when I fell off the wall, I have yet to meet climbers who are actually very good at this, to say, like, oh yeah, right when I fell, this happened and this, and then that caused this to happen. No, climbers are terrible at understanding the cause and effect, the logic, right? So we have to improve our ability of the logic, and then we will improve our climbing math, right? But if our goal in the end is climbing math, then we should improve our sequencing, because that's where the logic comes from.
That was good, Tim. I get it. I think that you provided some good framework there, and I actually really like that. I'm glad I kept on pushing you because it actually was really good. And it is a bit impossible to just give some kind of super practical advice, because you could literally take one boulder problem and you have an infinite amount of ways to do it, because there's an infinite number of people with infinite number of strengths on each different day too. And, oh, you got tape on your finger today. And it made me think of when you talked about it all comes crashing down in that one moment, all of your intuition. And I think about, this is one of the reasons why I like something like highballs or competitions, is because sometimes, like, what if you're up on a highball and all of a sudden, like, a hold breaks Like, oh, I was rehearsing this. Okay, now this foothold broke. It's not like this anymore. What now? And like, you don't really get to review your video or anything either. Like, it's kind of like, okay, now what? And the last thing I kind of wanted to leave everyone with is, again, trying to be a little practical, but just recognize that, like, sometimes you grab a hold and you're grabbing it in the best place. It feels like the best part of the hold, but that might be holding you back from grabbing the part up on the hold where it's an undercling, but it's not as good. And maybe that's the thing. Like, in, you know, people get suckered in, me included, to the good part of the hold. And I'm not saying that encompasses everything we're talking about. I'm just trying to use it again as an analogy, like, be creative. And sometimes you might find subtle flips, subtle movements, full crimping versus open handing, drop kneeing versus being square, and just understanding that you might be wrong. And so try different things. And you know, we've talked quite a bit about how your hands are on the wall and your feet are on the wall and shifting that weight. But one thing that is kind of impossible to talk about is there's also then an infinite amount of twisting your hips at just the right point in time and dropping one shoulder lower. And, you know, but it is infinitely complex. And I think what you talked about there was good at kind of setting a framework for people to grok how to go about this process. And the last thing I'll say is it is never ending. And there are things to me that are completely invisible that are really visible to pro climbers. And it's why I like surrounding myself with experts too, is seeing them do something and then just having my mind blown, and it will always happen. And it's also why it's good to have kids come along where they have a different idea about how to do things. So tough topic, Tim, but honestly, yeah, kind of the foundation for how to continue to climb harder.
Totally. I love like this one. Also, one more thing I'll wrap up with, and just to echo what, you know, Josh was saying about, I think like people aren't creative enough, you know, like, I will say that maybe there isn't one answer to like get better at this, even though I, you know, gave a lot of little framework for like the small things to start thinking about. But there is one big leak, in rock climbers, right? And the one big leak is that we don't believe enough things are possible. Right. That is the one big leak of all rock climbers, is that you don't believe that enough things are possible. You're not even close ever in any session, in any, and I don't even care if this is true. It's a philosophy that we should all believe. I don't believe in enough, right? If you and I session, Josh, like your goal in moonboarding, whether you like to believe it or not, is, all right, like last time I thought that this move was possible and this one wasn't, and this time I'm going to believe that this one is possible and prove it to myself through technique, through movements, through sequencing. And so, you know, if we fail at that first step, which is, no, for sure, I cannot do this movement this way. If you've just said that, you've already failed. If you've already failed, then there's no even point in continuing this path of sequencing. So don't fail that first step. The lowest hanging fruit there is to just believe a little bit extra, be a little bit extra creative in terms of how you can solve something. And, you know, a little secret here, if you're doing that on the moonboard, you may not find enough answers. That's why we like the moonboard, because it doesn't have variables, right? But if you're looking for more variables to solve and more obstacles to find more dimension, find more rock climbs, like find different things. I think like people inherently hate gym experiences or love gym experiences because of the setting that either invites one of these thought processes or another, where it shuts down your ability to think. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are like, I love power endurance trainer boulders because I feel like I can succeed on them more and more as I go up and further, right? It's like, well, maybe, but you're also like able to just use more technique. You're able to use, you know, more efficiency for, you know, getting more progress, but you're not really tapping into it. What about this powerful movement that is, you know, in B pump, where there are so many different ways to create and so many different little, you know, variables and obstacles that we have to kind of overcome. And that's what I really like about setting, is solving climbing, seeing what's difficult and like finding a better way, and through belief, right? I don't care if it's V4 and I'm supposed to be able to send it. No, F that, look at the climb, see what the best is, and let's do our best and, you know, find creative ways to get up this wall. With that mindset, I think we can sequence more.
Okay, Tim, I believe, good stuff, man. Yeah, that's heavy. Just really embracing the creativity is I think really important. And yeah, having a belief that there is a way through, and I like that you know, that language around not saying that you can't do something, but maybe you just haven't figured it out yet. I think that's an important mindset. And yeah, I'll leave it at that, Tim. I just awesome. Got my hands all sway for thinking about the my time getting back on the moon board. I will say that I would still argue that there is actually an infinite amount of creativity on the moon board still. And, you know, just the variables are smaller, you know, you have one foothold, but how you place your foot on that foothold, it can always be done better. It's just, you know, timing that with your pull, that's something I appreciate about the moon board. So I'm just going to defend my moon board journey a little bit, but other than that, yeah, that's all I got, Tim.
Awesome. Well, see you next week and hope you guys enjoyed.
Good stuff. Take care, man.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.